The government has clearly lost control of the economy.
We are looking at a Conservative majority of 86.
Why is the Prime Minister making a bad situation worse for working people by hammering them with a cut to universal credit and a tax rise?
I actually think that this is a win-win. It's an open goal for Liz Truss, really.
Will you shut up, man?
You said it on the record. You said you want to return.
And just to come in on something that you, Ed Miliband.
Order!
Bringing you the stories behind the headlines. You're listening to Politics Unboxed. Oh, you most certainly are listening to Politics Unboxed. Hello and welcome to the show. We're in the 1400 slot on Expression FM. It is the 19th of January 2023, and for the next 2 hours, oh yes, for the next glorious 2 hour stint, you're going to be listening to Politics Unboxed. My name is Rhys. I will be your host for today, and indeed for, you know, all of them, because it's kind of my show. But here we are, the first live Politics Unboxed of the year, and we've got some big stories to talk about. And I don't know where to start, to be brutally honest. Well, I know where some people would start. Some people would start with Jacinda Ardern, who is quitting as New Zealand's Prime Minister. Some people would start with Rishi Sunak, who's under fire for diverting some levelling up money to, the southeast of England. Labour aren't happy with that. Some people would talk about strikes. Some people would talk about how Number 10 Downing Street has told Conservative members to step up their attacks on Labour, with the PM's Chief of Staff instructing government advisers to come up with at least one attack line per week on their Labour counterparts. What a great consensus-driven politics. It really is a very fun time to be looking into UK politics. But let's start with a welcome back to the show, to the podcast, if you're listening on the podcast. We are live on Expression FM as this is going out, and it's going to be uploaded to wherever you get your podcasts as and when it can be done so. So if you're listening to this back and you wonder why there's a bit of a gap at some point during the show, well, that's because there was a music track there that I can't put up on Spotify. If you want, you know, come and tune in live, 2 till 4 every Thursday on Expression FM to hear my taste in music as well. Let's jump in to some of the headlines. But just remember, if you do hear something that you think, oh, yeah, I think that's quite an important story, I've got an opinion on that, what can you do?
Smash yourself.
Express yourself with Expression Hotline.
Call Expression.
Call 01392-723568.
Tell us what you want to hear. We might even get your voice on the airwaves. So pick up the phone and get ringing.
Express yourself.
Yeah, express yourself. Expression Hotline 01392-723568 is the number to call to get your voice on the airwaves. I mean, you don't have to. You can just sit back, tune in, and listen along. Or you can go to Instagram at politics.unboxed. You can go Facebook, Politics Unboxed. Or you can get in touch with me directly. That's if you have my contact details. Not giving them out here. That'd be silly. You've got to be in the know to have them. Right, let's stop this waffling and get on with the show. And we're going to start with an update on the Ukrainian war, or rather Russia's war in Ukraine. The Kremlin is warning today that European security is at risk if the West aids any attempt from Ukraine to retake Crimea. Now, President Zelensky, the Ukrainian president who's well, already he's been named Time Person of the Year in 2022. But he's been saying Crimea is our land, with Zelensky saying Ukraine can retake the peninsula. That was at the World Economic Forum in Davos. And it is kind of, you know, true. Crimea is Ukrainian by sort of how the land has been divided. Mr. Zelensky also said, peace talks are not peace. The parties need to realise it. For the past 3 years, we did everything we could to liberate our land through diplomacy. Some did not want to, did not have time, did not believe, put forward conditions. There were many such people, and the centre of that all was in Moscow. I don't quite understand how you can promise the European leaders one thing and start a war the next day. So that's President Zelensky speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos. Crimea is set to be the next major battleground in the war, although still everything is happening on that eastern front. Not that there is actually a western front, to be brutally honest, but it is very tough. It's brutal fighting, and these airstrikes are claiming lives on both sides. There's been a tit-for-tat retaliatory series of airstrikes on increasingly larger targets. As you heard in the bulletin that Vicky put together, a key Ukrainian minister, or rather the most senior Ukrainian to die in the war, killed in an airstrike just days ago. Today we see this nuclear threat from Russia. I mean, they do tend to ring hollow. Russia's got a considerable tactical nuclear arsenal, but they remain in storage. Western intelligence is confident that Russia hasn't even begun a process to reinstate them to battlefield readiness. Now, it could just be that this is saber-rattling from President Putin on the eve of a NATO meeting, because there's going to be a meeting tomorrow in Germany. Ukraine wants Leopard tanks from Germany. Germany will neither send any nor give permission to any other country to send any unless America also agrees to sending its own main battlefield tank. Now, this is sort of playing hardball around the NATO table. Maybe there will be concessions that Germany wants to drag out. Poland could defy that. We've heard that the Polish Prime Minister, he believes that permission is of secondary importance. We will either get it quickly or do what we see fit, saying that Warsaw may well send their Leopard tanks to Kyiv without Berlin's consent. The UK has said that we will be sending our Challenger? Yes, the Challenger tanks and also 600 Brimstone missiles into theatre. That's according to Defence Secretary Ben Wallace. He was giving a news conference about half an hour ago, maybe an hour or so ago, in Estonia. If Putin thinks we will get bored this year, he is wrong. That's Ben Wallace's words. I mean, this is very much a story that will continue to develop. I mean, we've seen how this developed over the course of last year. And I mean, it shows little sign of stopping. Unfortunately, the humanitarian crisis and other elements of the war will continue. It doesn't seem like Russia is in any mood to stand down its forces. But Ukraine is still on the offensive. It is still reclaiming ground. Whether or not we're going to see a renewed 2023 offensive from Russia, as some had been predicting, not sure. We will have to wait and see. And that's what we're going to have to do for quite a while. So, let's change the subject, because there's not too much that that I can really add to the discussion around, the Ukraine war that isn't already out in the open. And let's go north of the border. Because just last week, Rishi Sunak was up in Scotland for private talks with Nicola Sturgeon. And just a few days ago, Rishi Sunak's government, and specifically the Scotland Secretary, Alistair Jack, said that they would be using part of the Scotland Act 1998 for the first time ever. Now, I'm talking about Section 35 of the Scotland Act 1998, which specifically is, a veto power, pretty much. A 2012 Memorandum of Understanding refers to its use as a matter of last resort, but that's only really the Memorandum of Understanding. There's nothing legally that says it has to be just of last resort. Now, this is what's called a negative statutory instrument, which provides a legal instruction to the presiding officer of the Scottish Parliament not to present a bill to the monarch for royal assent. Section 35 can be used in two different situations, where the Scottish Secretary has reasonable grounds to believe that a Holyrood bill would either be incompatible with the UK's international obligations or not in the interests of national defence, or that it would modify the law on reserved matters in such a way to have an adverse effect on the operation of the law as it applies to reserved matters. Now, reserved matters, for the sake of devolution, are policy areas where the responsibility is that of the UK government and the UK Parliament. So defence, foreign affairs, equality legislation, somewhat. Now, this is all in relation to the Gender Recognition Reform (Scotland) Bill. Now, this is right at a crossroads between devolved and reserved powers. Gender recognition reform is a devolved matter. Equality legislation is officially devolved. But the bill itself has potential consequences for how the law would operate in so-called reserved areas. Equal Opportunities Law is the one that we're talking about, the Equality Act 2010. Now, the Gender Recognition Reform Bill would have lowered the age at which you can individually change your assigned gender from 18 to 16. It passed quite convincingly in the Scottish Parliament in Holyrood, 86 votes to 39. It is SNP policy. I don't know where the political blowback will fall. This is the first time that the UK government has ever used Section 35. It is, the first time it's ever been used, and it cannot be overturned by the Scottish Parliament. The Scottish government could amend and reconsider the Gender Recognition Reform Bill, or challenge the UK government's Section 35 order, which it looks certain to do so. That challenge would only really be successful if they can argue that the Secretary of State for Scotland lacked reasonable grounds for believing the bill would have an adverse effect on how the law operates with respect to reserved matters. It would either be found to be a lawful action or unlawful. Then, if it's found unlawful, the Section 35 order would cease to have any legal force and the bill would go through for royal assent because it's already past the other stages. So this is a very, very tricky area. this is a big clash. As I say, the first time that this provision from the Scotland Act 1998 has ever been used. 25-year-old piece of legislation. Never been used before. And it's on a really hot-button topic. This is something that, well, trans activists have been fighting for, removing medical, legal and administrative hurdles which must currently be cleared by someone wishing to change the sex recorded on their birth certificate. Those who are sort of in favour of the government's action on this has said that allowing someone to self-identify in their gender would impinge on Westminster Equalities Law. They'd make it more difficult for women-only spaces to exclude people who were born biologically male. Now, some people would have issue in that regard. What is the difference between someone who's undergone a full gender reassignment surgery and someone who was born biologically female? If we're talking about someone going from male to female. So there are a lot of questions to be asked about this. All of the major parties are actually pretty split on this issue. The SNP are quite split. The Conservatives are definitely split. Well, we know where the government stand, but the rest of the party, who knows? But the Labour Party are getting themselves into really a bit of a tricky situation because they aren't particularly coming forward on this issue because they can't. Because they know there are differing opinions within their own party that make it very difficult to come forward with a unified opinion. Now, there's a possible concern that with this being such a controversial piece of legislation, the SNP will use it as part of a Democracy Denied campaign. That's controversial within the SNP itself, really, because some senior figures worry that this is a very controversial and hot topic issue. What if we sort of turn away potential voters by making this the figurehead of why we're all fighting for independence and that sort of thing? But like I said, this is going to drag out. The courts will now see. It's definitely going to the Court of Session. It may well go to the UK Supreme Court down in London. People close to Nicola Sturgeon actually sound confident of victory in a legal battle. But if they lose, well, trans rights campaigners would say the SNP, even by passing this legislation, is putting itself on the right side of history. But as we know, LGBT rights are often used as a bit of a political football. Much to the detriment of people who actually need action on these issues rather than just talk. Is it just the SNP playing political games? Or is that too cynical? Whitehall lawyers are definitely going to have to cancel their Easter holidays, though, because this isn't the only issue to involve the UK government that's probably going to head to court. Migrants facing potential removal to Rwanda have been granted permission to challenge the Home Office. Unions are threatening legal action over plans by the Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy Department to enforce minimum service levels during industrial action, and that's something we'll talk about later in the show, and also expanding the powers of the police to tackle public protests in England and Wales. That has the potential, heavy potential, for a legal challenge. There's a lot of conflict in this government, It's meant to be the steady hand after the turbulence of Truss and Johnson. But is this just tough talking to try and promote a backwards piece of action? Who knows, really? We'll have to wait and see. And I don't know whether Rishi Sunak will be able to hold his own in this one. Well, we will definitely have to wait and see. Right, we are going to go to a song break now. And I was wondering, what song do I go for? And I was sort of looking through the various tracks we have on our wonderful system here. And I was thinking, I could play a Jimi Hendrix song. I could play a Green Day song. And I think, no, I play them all the time on the show. Why don't I play a Foo Fighters song? So, let's play a Foo Fighters song. We'll be back after this. What a tune that is. Are You Mine by the Arctic Monkeys. And of course, Learn to Fly by the Foo Fighters. It was before that one. We are going to go to another section of the news now, because Rishi Sunak has been, accused of giving money to all the wrong places. The latest allocation of levelling up money has happened, and more money has gone to the southeast of England than the northeast. In terms of funding per person, the Prime Minister was keen to defend the fact that the north received the most amount of cash, and the government has argued that parts of the south are deprived and need investment. But Labour are claiming northeast England is one of the biggest losers from an unfair and failed funding model. A total of 111 areas across the UK have been awarded money from the second round of the Levelling Up Fund, with the Eden Project in Morecambe, Lancashire getting about £50 million to help regenerate a derelict site into an eco-tourism attraction. There's also going to be a new direct train service linking Cornwall's largest urban areas, but London boroughs will get more than both Yorkshire and the northeast of England. Rishi Sunak is currently on a tour of the north of England. It's the first time for everything. Although he is, of course, a Yorkshire MP representing Richmond. And he said, 2/3 of all the Levelling Up funding is going to the most deprived parts of our country. Levelling Up is about making people feel pride in the places they call home. It's about driving jobs and investment. Now, £19 million is going to Richmond in North Yorkshire. Oh, that's the Prime Minister's seat. What a fun coincidence. But during an event in Morecambe, he was asked if the distribution of funding was in any way politically motivated. Rishi Sunak said that around half of the funds had gone to non-conservative areas. Not the question, was it? The London borough of Camden is going to receive £7 million for cycling and walking infrastructure and local GP services. Now that sounds like a great move there. Well done, congratulations, giving money for a GP surgery and some infrastructure improvements. Well, Shadow Levelling Up Secretary Lisa Nandy has said it takes an extraordinary arrogance to expect us to be grateful for a partial refund on the money the Conservatives have stripped out of our communities. Ah. Well, when you put it like that, it does seem to be a little bit of a slap in the face. There have been extensive cuts to local services and local authorities' funding. So this really isn't that much of a boom, to be brutally honest. There's been a real competitive style bidding process that has sort of driven the levelling up or reducing regional inequality funding process. And I don't know whether that's the most efficient and effective way. Should areas of the UK have to sort of say, no, I'm worse than you are, in sort of a drawn-out version of the four Yorkshiremen. Now, there are some fun-looking sort of projects. £50 million for Crossrail Cardiff. A new train line is going to be built between Cardiff Bay and Cardiff Central Station. There's going to be a roll-on, roll-off ferry for Fair Isle in Shetland. £40 million for carbon-neutral education camps in Blackpool Town Centre. I've got no idea what they are either. £5.1 million to build new female changing rooms in 20 rugby clubs across Northern Ireland. £19 million, just over, to improve public spaces in Hackney Central. And £45 million to help the Port of Dover operate more efficiently, including adding more border control points. That sounds fun. Doesn't really sound like levelling up. It does sound more like a cheeky way to get more money into your border security without having to find cuts in the Home Office. Oopsies. The northwest of England is going to receive the most money, £354 million. The southeast coming in second with £210 million. And London, £151 million. Northern Ireland and the northeast are regions that have been allocated the least amount of money, £71 million for Northern Ireland and £108 million for the northeast. This is the second part of levelling up funding. The first part was announced back in October of 2021. There was 105 projects that bid successfully, and they split £1.7 billion between them. Now, with all of this talk about levelling up, are we any closer to knowing what levelling up actually means? Because CCHQ, the Conservative campaign headquarters, have had to deny reports they've told MPs in marginal seats to stop using the phrase levelling up because the public, well, there are concerns they don't really know what it means. A Conservative source, however, told the BBC that MPs have been told the precise opposite and have been told how best to use the phrase based on the party's opinion research. But the BBC has been told that MPs have been told just to talk to constituents about how much money, sorry, not just to talk about how much money has been spent, but about specific things that have changed for their area. £2 billion of the public money is being distributed across the nation by a bunch of civil servants who have probably not been to the vast majority of places they are distributing money to. How can this be sensible? That's from Philip Rycroft. He was a former top civil servant. He worked in the Department for Exiting the European Union. And he's called the whole process of distributing funding completely crackers. At the Local Government Association, and Kevin Bentley from it, says the allocation of funding should be locally led by evidence rather than based on costly competitive bids between areas. And he also warned fulfilling projects have become challenging due to rising inflation and cost. The head of the Local Government Information Unit think tank, Jonathan Carr West, said people will debate whether these allocations are fair or right. But the real problem here is that this is a crazy way to fund local government. Hear, hear. It really is quite astounding. I don't really know why we had to cut back on local funding so much so that you now have to do as I said earlier, that sort of four Yorkshiremen sketch of, no, I have it worse off than you. Who knows? Who knows how this is actually going to go? Let's move on. Let's talk about attack ads and attack lines, because we live in an adversarial system of government, realistically. Not quite as adversarial as the United States, but here in the United Kingdom, there are still really only two parties who can be the party of government right now, realistically, and they are the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, which means that it is often a lot more politically expedient, potentially, to attack your opposition rather than to offer reasons why you should vote for your side of the whole ordeal. In this adversarial world, though, that means you need to have attack lines and attack ads. And as I said at the top of the show, the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff has instructed government advisers to come up with at least one attack line per week on their Labour counterparts. It's not just Conservative advisers, though. Labour have a director of attack and rebuttal. They're responsible for producing and disseminating information to support the party's election strategy. They may be against opposing MPs in the House of Commons. They might just be social media or, you know, the odd line that you'll just say at the end of an interview so you can get a journalist to say, well, senior sources are suggesting that, blah, blah, blah. It could be about personal integrity. It could be about their department's policies. It could be their character. Number 10, setting up a weekly target, however, well, they're stepping up preparations for a tough general election. It's going to be very tough. Liam Booth-Smith, Rishi Sunak's chief of staff, has been advising these civil servants on this. Civil servants who advise ministers have to remain politically neutral, but it's these special advisers on the government payroll who can help ministers on work where government business overlaps with party political and campaigning matters. Now, the next general election obviously doesn't have to be until January 2025. However, with local elections just under 4 months away now, in May, that's going to be a real testing ground for how the parties are looking like they will do for the next general election. A Labour source has said the public don't need cheap political point scoring, but a focus on delivering solutions. I wonder whether that came from their director of attack and rebuttal. Who knows? Let's talk strikes. Why not? Unions have called the new strikes bill undemocratic, unworkable and illegal. That's fun. Not pulling any punches there. Under the proposal, some public sector workers would be required to work during a strike. Here's what the business secretary said in the Commons. Ooh, if it plays.
Whilst we absolutely believe in the right to strike, We're duty bound to protect the lives and the livelihoods of the British people.
Yeah.
The British people need to know that when they have a heart attack, a stroke or a serious injury, that an ambulance will turn up. And that if the need and if they need hospital care, they have access to it. And that's because they need to know that not only are those services available, but they're able to get trains and buses, particularly for those who are most likely to be the least well-off in society.
Business Secretary Grant Shapps there. You could hear the heckling from the Labour benches there and various other opposition parties probably as well at some of his comments. And, I mean, there are allegations of the Conservative Party having underfunded public sector for quite a while. So it's a bit hypocritical to say that they should now have to put in these sort of minimum service levels on the public sector. The aim is to protect lives and livelihoods. Well, I don't know. It's a political football here. This legislation, according to the head of the Trade Unions Congress, Paul Nowak, or Novak, I think, says this legislation would mean that when workers democratically vote to strike, they can be forced to work and sacked if they don't comply. That's undemocratic, unworkable, and almost certainly illegal. This bill was published on Tuesday. It comes amid a wave of industrial action across the public sector, with workers seeking pay increases in the face of the rising cost of living crisis. But this isn't actually any surprise that these bills are coming through. It's just the timing that's making it slightly more, controversial, problematic. Depends on where you're standing. Laws requiring a minimum level of service during strikes had been promised for public transport as part of the Tories' 2019 manifesto, but the government's now seeking to extend the requirement to five other areas: the NHS, education, fire and rescue, border security, and nuclear decommissioning. To meet these minimum staffing levels, which we don't know yet, they're still to be decided, employers would issue a work notice to unions setting out who is required to work during a strike. Under the legislation, there would then be no automatic protection from unfair dismissal for an employee who is told to work under minimum service agreements but chooses to strike. Grant Shapps, however, doesn't think workers would be sacked. "No one is talking about sacking nurses," said the business secretary. "Nothing we're announcing today in this bill from the dispatch box is about getting rid of nurses any more than any employment contract has to be followed." Except it isn't. Because whilst Mr. Shapps can stand up at the dispatch box and say he absolutely believes in the right to strike, he does seem rather insistent on gutting it. Mr. Shapps has also accused unions representing ambulance workers of a lack of timely cooperation, which he said meant employers could not reach a national agreement for minimum safety levels during recent strikes. He said it made contingency planning almost impossible and put lives at risk. Unite's Sharon Graham called this completely false, saying agreements had been negotiated with regional managers to take into account local circumstances, and the GMB said it was an extraordinary attack on ambulance workers who had actually left picket lines on occasion to respond to urgent calls. During December's strikes, all Category 1 calls, classed as the most life-threatening situations, were responded to by an ambulance, and this was the case for yesterday's strike as well. But there is no blanket agreement being reached on Category 2 calls, that includes strokes or major burns, with unions agreeing locally which calls within this category will be responded to. The Fire Brigade's Union General Secretary, Matt Rack, called the bill a shameful attack on democratic rights and key workers. I don't think that's far from the truth. Sharon Graham, the Unite's, one of the representatives, has called it a dangerous gimmick from a government that should be negotiating to resolve the current crisis they have caused. Oh, yes. Grant Shapps, back when he was Transport Secretary, briefly, he was almost unilaterally slated for his unwillingness, or his lack of willing to actually get round the table and negotiate with the RMT. So, it's no surprise that Mick Lynch, head of the RMT union, said the draconian legislation sought to punish workers for demanding decent pay and working conditions. The Labour leader Angela Rayner has called it utterly stupid and insulting for Mr. Shapps to go from thanking nurses to proposing to sack them for striking. I mean, obviously, that's a slight oversimplification, but there is a point behind that. How can he seriously think that sacking thousands of key workers won't just plunge our public services further into crisis, said Miss Rayner in the Commons on Tuesday. MPs are going to get a chance to debate this bill next week, and it will make it through the House of Commons. The Conservatives are going to vote on this. It's going to go through very, very easily. But the House of Lords may well pose an issue, where numbers for the Conservatives are slightly less favourable. Any legislation, though, would not have any impact on strikes this month, which are still set to go ahead. Nurses in England set to be on strike next week. There is, however, a point behind all of these strikes, which, really does bear thinking about. Because these unions aren't just going out on strike for the hell of it. They aren't just going out on strike because, we're bored, want to do something on the weekend. Not on the weekend, on a work day instead. This is about how people's living conditions are, how pay rises and other avenues of funding and in-work benefits and in-work responsibilities go. These are critical issues, and nothing will ever be solved by intransigence on either side. But it looks particularly like the government at the moment are being the more intransigent, because we've seen some striking unions cancel or postpone days of action because of adverse circumstances, because they think it would be in the national interest. It's funny that the unions are the ones who are having this, in the national interest argument, and it sounds rather like they would win it if they had that argument, because I'm not quite sure where the government are standing on this one. There are other strike proposals going on. In Wales, there are going to be school strikes. Teachers and school heads were in a meeting with the Welsh Government's Education Minister this Thursday morning, where they were offered a one-off payment, similar to a payment made to health workers last week to postpone a strike, and they rejected the offer. Senior officials in two unions said it did not go far enough, and talks with Jeremy Miles, who was, is still the Welsh Government's Education Minister, came ahead of 4 days of planned strikes by the National Education Union. An NEU representative claimed a large number of schools in Wales will have to close. However, Jeremy Miles says he's unsure that would happen. Not all teachers are planning to walk out, but a representative of one of the other major teaching unions, NASUWT, said their members would not do the work of striking teachers. Representatives met the Welsh Government's Jeremy Miles and the Welsh Local Government Association in an online meeting this morning where this one-off payment was offered. It didn't really work with nurses, and it hasn't really worked with the education unions. The one-off payment wasn't enough to stop the Royal College of Nurses to, actually sort of stop declaring more walkouts. And strikes in the ambulance service have continued. So it's sort of, the definition of insanity, you know? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. That could never be accused of doing that for the Welsh government, could it? No. Meaningful negotiations? Well, maybe. Who knows? At least we're now seeing some levels of negotiations. People getting round the table, starting to talk things out. Like, everyone has to in the end anyway. It's always going to come round to who can get round the table and talk. But it's just a matter of what action gets done first. Some worrying pieces of legislation came through in the 2022 session of Parliament for the right to strike. Maybe 2023 really doesn't have much in the way of hope for the unions on the legislative front. We're going to go to a song break because I can tell I'm rambling. We are going to go to possibly a very well-timed song. I don't know. Hit it. Oh, there we are. Slightly there. Can you still hear it? I can. I love it. Great song. Layla, Derek and the Dominoes. And before that, you heard Fight for Your Right, Beastie Boys. Nice little segue song there, Fight for Your Right, talking about strikes, you know. Let's keep talking about strikes, actually, because France is up in arms. There are strikes right now, and a big day of action. It's a make-or-break moment for President Emmanuel Macron, whose reform programme is facing massive backlash. What's the reform, I hear you ask? How can it have so much backlash? Well, it's to push back the age of retirement. Yay. A new bill due to go through Parliament, the French Parliament, will raise the official age at which people can stop work from 62 to 64. Because under proposals outlined earlier this month by Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne, from 2027, people will have to work 43 years to qualify for a full pension, as opposed to 42 now. Public transport has ground to halt. Many schools are closed. There are more than 200 protests across France with massive turnout. the biggest, taking place in Paris. Big unions set to march from the Place de la République across the city during the afternoon. Tens of thousands of protesters marched during the morning in Nantes, Lyon, Bordeaux, Marseille and Toulouse. Train drivers, public sector workers and refinery staff all walked out. On some rail lines, as few as 1 in 10 services were operating. The Paris metro was a ghost town. The main education union for secondary education in France said that 65% of its teachers were on strike. The education ministry says 35%. Who'd you believe? Philippe Martinez, the head of the CGT union, predicted more than 1 million people would take to the streets. I know, you're going to count the police as well? Because they were out to ward off violence from the ultra-left black bloc infiltrators. Try saying that with a mouthful of marshmallows. The French government, called this a vital measure to safeguard France's share-out pension system. But it is very unpopular. 68% of people, according to an IFOP poll this week, are opposed to this. All the country's unions have condemned the measure, as well as the left-wing and far-right oppositions in the National Assembly. Emmanuel Macron was on a visit to Spain on Thursday. That's today. But Labour Minister Olivier Dussopt warned that some opponents were using the issue to spread fake news and play on people's fears. La République En Marche, or as it's now called, Renaissance, the party Emmanuel Macron represents, doesn't have a majority in the National Assembly, so he'll have to rely on support from 60 or so Conservative members from Les Républicains. They are, in principle, in favour of this pension reform, but even some of them have warned they might vote against the action. This process is expected to take weeks, but Emmanuel Macron is now facing a rolling campaign of opposition. Further days of action are expected. But the real worst outcome would be rolling strikes across transport, hospitals and fuel depots, which could bring the country to a standstill. France is notorious for its strikes, really. We saw that the Gilets Jaunes protesters earlier in Emmanuel Macron's presidency, and now we're seeing this massive walkout. Political analysts, they don't know which way the country is going to go. We don't know whether the scale of this movement could be enough to force Macron to back down. But if this was enough to force him to back down, it could mark the end of any serious reforms for his second term. I mean, on one hand, inflation, you have the energy crisis, rundown public services, that's left a lot of people feeling anxious and easily angered, especially at Emmanuel Macron, who has a very poor image outside the main metropolitan city centres in France. But on the other hand, there is also a sense of apathy and resignation, and there are some who no longer identify with the sort of union activity that we've seen throughout France's history. The Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, tried to invoke the principle of intergenerational solidarity to try and justify the decision to make people work longer. This is because, you know, very few people have personal pension plans linked to capital investments in the French system. It's not like there's these hedge funds. Instead, pensions of those who are retired are paid from the same common fund into which those in work contribute every month. Workers get the benefits of the same treatment when they retire. The government says the system is heading for disaster because there are substantially more people who are retired than those who are working. I mean, there used to be 4 workers per retiree 50 years ago. It's now down to about 1.7 workers per retiree. It's going to drop further. Nearly all European countries have done this to raise the official retirement age. Italy and Germany, 67. Spain, 65. The UK, 66. And this isn't the first time Emmanuel Macron has tried this. He tried in 2019 with a real ambitious attempt to reform the system. Something got in the way. Something that happened in 2020. Oh, yeah. I know, COVID. But this plan was part of his re-election manifesto. A key argument from his government. But you know, maybe it hasn't gone the way he expected. This is going to be the seventh French pension reform since François Mitterrand and his action in 1982, cutting the retirement age to 60. And all of the subsequent attempts to reverse that change led to mass opposition. The most successful one, though, was in 2010. Nicolas Sarkozy raised the retirement age back up to 62, despite weeks of protests. I guess if you can spare the political capital, and it doesn't look like Macron's gonna run again. I don't actually know if that's within the French constitution. I think it's only once renewable, so Macron can't run again. Well, if he doesn't have to win over the public anymore, he can just do what he thinks is best for the country. Isn't that great? Totally altruistic president of France. Brilliant. Can you tell I'm being sarcastic? Anyway, this is very much a make-or-break moment. You get the picture that if Macron backs down here, he won't get anything else done. He'll be essentially a lame duck because he's making the left wing irate, he's making the right wing irate. There isn't really much room in the squeezed middle. So from one political story about retirement to another, or rather not quite retirement, but resignation. And after 6 years, Jacinda Ardern is quitting as New Zealand's Prime Minister. There's an election this year. Her Labour Party, well, I don't know whether it's going to be able to win the next election. It's going to be hard. But after 6 years, New Zealand's Labour Party will vote to find her replacement on Sunday. She's going to step down by the 7th of February. But if no would-be successor can get two-thirds of the parliamentary party's support, the vote goes to Labour's lay membership, so sort of the overall members. Jacinda Ardern was the youngest female head of government in the world when she was elected Prime Minister, aged 37, 6 years ago in 2017. And a year later, she became just the second elected world leader ever to give birth whilst in office. That first goes to Benazir Bhutto, the leader of Pakistan, back in 1990. It's been a quite astounding 5.5, 6 years of, what Jacinda Ardern has had to sit through as Prime Minister. The COVID-19 pandemic, the recession that came after it, shootings at the mosque in Christchurch, volcanic eruption on the White Island. I mean, they've clearly been taxing. That's what Jacinda Ardern said. She no longer has enough in the tank to lead. And I guess it shows that, yeah, it is a real person behind that podium and that lectern. An absolute star on the world stage, Jacinda Ardern. I don't think you could go very far without finding someone who knew her, or knew of her anyway. National Party leader Chris Luxon thanked Miss Ardern for her service to New Zealand. That's the opposition leader in New Zealand. Anthony Albanese, I can never pronounce his surname, the new Prime Minister of Australia, called her a fierce advocate for New Zealand, an inspiration to so many and a great friend to me. At the moment, they're still heads of the sister parties, the Antipodean sister parties of the Labour Party in Australia and New Zealand. Justin Trudeau said she had made an immeasurable difference to the world. That's Canada's Prime Minister. But while she was a political star globally, well, opinion polls were dropping for her. After a landslide election victory in 2020, capitalising on what was seen as a very effective early response to the pandemic, her personal popularity is currently at its lowest since she was elected, with her party's performance predicted to be similarly low. I mean, Jacinda Ardern told the BBC her declining popularity was the price her government had paid for keeping people safe from COVID-19, but I guess She's also got, you know, the cost of living crisis, national crime scares, and a massive backlog of election promises that were put off during the pandemic. It's going to be a big change on the world stage. You don't really see many sort of leaders from New Zealand make as big of a splash as Jacinda Ardern has. It's going to be a bit of a change. Jacinda Ardern says, "I'm not leaving because I believe we can't win this election, but because I believe we can and will win, and we need a fresh set of shoulders for that challenge. I hope I leave New Zealanders with a belief that you can be kind but strong, empathetic but decisive, optimistic but focused, and that you can be your own kind of leader, one who knows when it's time to go." It's a shame she wasn't in the UK. yeah. Jacinda Ardern leaving her role as Prime Minister of New Zealand. She is, however, going to be able to finally get married to her partner, Clark Gayford, who they've been together for quite a while. Didn't get married whilst she was in office. I guess it probably would have been maybe a little bit indulgent to be able to be marrying as the Prime Minister. But whether or not she'll even run as an MP again, it's doubtful, let's be honest. She has, however, got a strong future ahead of her. She's only 42. She's got plenty to go. I mean, she could sweep up on the after-dinner speaking tour for the rest of her life. She'd be minted. As we see from sort of Theresa May, how well the after-dinner speaking circuit goes for former prime ministers of Anglophone countries. And, of course, Boris Johnson earning a lot of money now. He's earning a lot of money already, actually. But, I mean, good luck to her. It's been fun watching her from afar as a little exploration into a different style of politics. It never seemed particularly adversarial from Jacinda Ardern, even when she was sort of very much chewing out the opposition for not supporting the government. Ah, well, she will be missed, probably. I don't know, maybe some people in New Zealand would be glad to see the back of her if her opinion polling is dropping. But, you know, there are certainly people who would have liked her to stay. Auckland Pride's Max Tweedy says she's one of the greatest prime ministers in New Zealand's history. And Sam Neill, the famous Kiwi actor, said she deserved so much better after facing disgraceful treatment from what he labelled bullies and misogynists. But Jacinda Ardern there as she leaves her role as Prime Minister of New Zealand. Must admit, I wasn't expecting it. It was a bit of a shock announcement. Anyway, let's go from one far-flung Anglophone country with a bit of a political crisis to another one. God bless the USA. A lot has happened since I was last able to speak to you about the US of A. We have a new Speaker of the House of Representatives, and the Speaker is weaker than ever. We'll talk about that in a sec. The US might be about to run up against the country's debt limit. Yeah, it's big. That's a big thing to talk about. And also, we'll be able to talk about some of the new congressional members, including New York Republican George Santos. And there's an interesting story about him. There's plenty of interesting stories about George Santos, actually. But let's start with Kevin McCarthy, the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, some could say the weaker of the House. He is very much, I suppose you could say, in office but not in power. It took 15 rounds of voting to get Kevin McCarthy to hold that famous gavel. We haven't seen that since before the US Civil War, that number of votes. In fact, it's the first time in 100 years it's taken even more than one round of voting to elect a speaker. Congress, or the House of Representatives, is back in Republican hands for the first time since 2019. And electing a speaker may end up being actually the easy part for this Republican majority. A slim majority, though, as evidenced by Kevin McCarthy's own struggles. I mean, the first issue on the table is to sort out who is actually going to be where and how the House of Representatives will operate. So the Republican from California has quite a tricky job. All the committees are very much, I was going to say political, but they're always political in anywhere. But these are massive. The committees are very powerful in the House of Representatives. And one of the very important committees is the Rules Committee, which decides the timing and terms for every major vote in the chamber. Kevin McCarthy had to give away 3 spots on that committee to Freedom Caucus members, people who were standing in the way of Kevin McCarthy becoming the Speaker. These sort of, I suppose, maybe in the past you'd have called them Tea Party Republicans or MAGA Republicans. It's crucial that he's given away 3 seats on that committee because there are only 13 seats on that committee. And the same for most committees. It's normally made up of 7 Republicans and 6 Democrats when the Republicans are in majority, and then the other way around, 7 Democrats, 6 Republicans when the Democrats are in the majority. And there are loads of committees. As well as that, in a change from how the House has run in the past, there will now be the possibility to have just one member force a vote on what's known as a motion to vacate. Now, that's a posh way of saying a no-confidence vote in the Speaker themselves. Now, under the Democrats, that had been raised to 5, so not exactly massively prohibitive. You can definitely get 5 people who don't like Nancy Pelosi together in a room, and you could have got 5 people who don't like Kevin McCarthy together in a room. But now it's just one person, so giving a lot of power to the Speaker's own party there to keep him in check. There's also a concession that each bill must have longer consideration time before a final vote. A few of the, issues and problems with how the Democrats have been running the House and the Republicans before them had been just how much time is in that legislative session. And a lot of the work on bills was done behind closed doors in a committee room, just sort of, you know, hammering out a deal, and then it goes to the floor of the House, you vote on party lines, it goes through, sorted. The main legislative work, the main deliberative work was done in, not private, because you can see that. You can look at the minutes of a committee meeting, you can watch it if you so wish, but not done on the full floor of the House. These proposed rule changes, though, could affect policy. There will also probably be a much more stringent level of constraints on new government spending. It's going to be harder to pass bills in the House to raise taxes and to approve defence and social spending. Those are some of the things we know Kevin McCarthy has conceded to. There's also a very big question mark: who is going to chair the various committees and subcommittees? Because they are powerful roles. I'm just going to look up the House of Representatives committees. Some of the big ones are really quite important. I mean, obviously, you've got one for each of the main departments, sort of agriculture, appropriations, armed services. A big one is the Budget Committee, or the United States House Committee on the Budget. Looks like Jody Arrington's going to take that, Republican from Texas. Education and Commerce is also quite big. The Ethics Committee is big. And that looks like the Ethics Committee are going to have a chance to investigate Joe Biden. Michael Guest is the current acting head of the Ethics Committee, the acting chairperson. The Democrats get to pick someone who is sort of the ranking member. That's currently Susan Wild from Pennsylvania. The Financial Services Committee with Patrick McHenry from North Carolina. Oh, what a smart bow tie in that man's picture. Love it. love a good bow tie because bow ties are cool. At the Foreign Affairs Committee, Homeland Security, House Administration, that's quite important as well. The Judiciary Committee is very important, and that's currently headed up by Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, who is a staunch McCarthy loyalist, but also a sort of darling of the Tea Party sort of Freedom Caucus. He was actually voted for in the race for Speaker. He never officially declared himself, but he was voted for. He is a Republican from Ohio. He looks like he's going to take the chairmanship of the House Committee on the Judiciary, but also a new select committee, the United States House Judiciary Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. This was created on the 10th of January to investigate alleged abuses of federal authority. This was a big, big concession from McCarthy. I don't know how it's going to be. This is of investigating the investigators. Democrats are not planning to boycott this committee. There was previously the United States House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol, which Republicans did after Jim Jordan and Jim Banks were nominated to that select committee and then rejected by Nancy Pelosi. It's expected that Dan Bishop and Thomas Massey will be part of the subcommittee led by Jim Jordan. Jerry Nadler, who is the head of the Judiciary Committee, will probably serve on that. But Kevin McCarthy will not allow Adam Schiff, Eric Swalwell, or Ilhan Omar to serve on the subcommittee. Those are three sort of left-wing Democrats. And Adam Schiff is the sort of head of the, or was the head of the Investigations Committee, which announced the impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump. Some members of the Democrats have actually called this the Tinfoil Hat Committee. Jerry Nadler, who's probably going to be on the subcommittee, has called it fueled by conspiracy theories and slated to be run by the most extreme members of the MAGA caucus. Unlike the Church Committee, he says, which was a serious and bipartisan attempt to reform the conduct of the intelligence community based on hard, identifiable evidence. I mean, the Progressive Squad, which actually includes Ilhan Omar, have called it the Insurrection Protection Committee. Yeah, they don't mince words, do they? But to go back to the point I was making, I know, it feels like ages ago that I was actually talking about a point. These committee chairs have a lot of power. Like, a lot of power. You have a lot of influence over what gets called before the committee, who gets called before the committee, how the committee gives its recommendations. So the leaders of these committees are incredibly important to have on your side if you want to be an effective speaker. And again, the speaker gets officially to choose who gets to sit on these committees. Normally it's just, we'll wave them through as long as they're nominated by their own party. Sometimes, as I say though, that does change. You do get nominations being rejected, which normally causes a bit of a political firestorm. Right, what else does Kevin McCarthy have to do? Well, the debt ceiling. It appears we're headed for a game of brinksmanship in the House of Representatives, because by law, the US government has a cap on the amount of new debt it can issue, and Congress has to periodically vote to raise that cap. During the Obama presidency, the Republicans threatened to block an increase in the debt limit unless Democrats agreed to spending cuts. And that was somewhat effective. Conservative Republicans are itching for a fight when the US reaches its debt limit. That's going to happen soon. What happens when the US hits the debt limit? Well, not much for the first few months. The US Treasury can manage the situation by doing things called extraordinary measures to avoid actually breaching the limit. It can suspend investments and retirement and health benefits and then top them up at a later date. But they do have a real price. S&P Credit Ratings Agency in 2011 downgraded the country's credit rating for the first time as a result of a standoff back then under the Obama presidency. But the special measures, according to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, can only buy time for the US until June, at which point the government will no longer be able to pay its bills. And that's the scenario that most analysts are seeing as true economic catastrophe. In this event, some say authorities would have to do as much as they can to avoid defaulting on their debts. So make interest payments whilst other obligations go unpaid, on things like defence contractor payments, social security checks, which are the things that those of the pension age get across the country. Salaries of government employees might be cut, including the military. And that's a group of people you probably don't want to annoy or underfund. Even things as basic as the weather forecast, because the government, the US government, funds the National Weather Service. And default could ruin the credit rating, trustworthiness, and really get the backup of the global financial market. Under this, you'd see the dollar weaken, borrowing costs spike, first for the government, then for the broader public. There'd be higher interest rates, credit card debt, mortgages, other loans, they'd all get higher interest rates. And it would be unprecedented to get to that point. Failure to meet the government's obligations would cause irreparable harm to the US economy, the livelihoods of all Americans, and global financial stability, according to Janet Yellen. Now, this is an issue. The debt limit was first introduced in 1917 to try and increase flexibility during the First World War on money-raising issues. And in theory, it gives Congress a way to check in on spending. But fights over the ceiling become increasingly fractious because political polarization and US debt have both incredibly increased. US debt roughly doubling in a decade. Major government spending during the financial crisis and the pandemic, that's one of the reasons, but it's also a reflection the country consistently runs a budget deficit, and it has done every year since 2001. Now, some Republicans in the House are pushing for big spending cuts, like they did in 2011, when President Barack Obama agreed to spending cuts worth more than £900 billion in order to get the House Republicans to give him more money in the debt ceiling. Democrats are rejecting these Republican advances, though. It's going to be close. The last time it happened, I believe, was 2021. And that happened just days before a US, or potential US credit default. President Joe Biden signed it into law to raise the US borrowing limit by $2.5 trillion, just under £2 trillion, and it passed very narrowly. Democrats and Republicans normally vote together to raise or suspend the debt ceiling, but they didn't that time. It passed in the Senate 50 votes to 49, and it was only after an agreement between Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, which saw 14 Republicans vote along with every Senate Democrat to change the rules on a one-time-only rule change, because there's something in the Senate called a filibuster, which means that essentially if you don't have 60 votes, I know it's weird because there are 100 representatives, but if you don't have 60 votes, then you can't bring a bill to be debated yet. Or rather, you can bring it to be debated, but you can't end the debate and bring it to a vote. And that was lifted for a one-time-only rule change. Don't think that's going to be happening at the moment. Anyway, to get back to Kevin McCarthy's struggles, in the autumn, it'll be fun, because there'll be a budget battle. There are only a couple of obligatory items in the sort of congressional calendar. Raising the debt limit, that pretty much is obligatory now. The other, approving the budget. Now, this showdown won't happen until sort of end of October 2023 for the start of the 2024 government fiscal year. But, oh my word, are people on both sides chomping at the bit for a fight. Conservative Republicans, one promises to make spending cutting a priority during the budgeting. And as Speaker, Kevin McCarthy has pledged to help Republicans balance the federal budget within 10 years and has given them lots of tools to help pass budget-cutting bills. But, because the Republicans lost in the Senate, Anything House Republicans pass will have to be approved by Democrats in the Senate, which won't really stand by and let the House representatives go through a sort of draconian agenda. There's a lot of stuff in the rules that restricts federal spending. How is that going to pass the Senate? It's not, said one Republican. So right off the bat, we have a new process for appropriations that will never come to fruition in terms of law. That alone could be frustrating. There are also potential Democratic saboteurs. I know, it sounds like a political thriller, but it's real. Last week proved, or rather a couple of weeks ago now, proved that Republicans really have a bit of a hard time reaching an agreement even amongst themselves. Now add on top a Democratic minority, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic president. They will be doing anything that they can to keep things ticking away on their side of the agenda. The new rules package, it's brilliant for the individual House Republicans who want to get things. It's also brilliant for the individual House Democrats. They can force votes on issues like abortion, healthcare, gun control. They really are divisive. And even within the Republican Party, between the conservative and moderate factions. Also, in some high-stakes negotiations over debt limits and budgets, Democrats in the Senate may well end up negotiating with Republicans there, and then staring down House Republicans as if to challenge them to block compromises. All whilst Joe Biden stands behind the press lectern in the White House press room to say, look at how well the parties are working together, except for the conservative House Republicans. Yeah. I mean, he's been around a while. He knows how to run a political sort of ambush, really. Although it wouldn't be an ambush if the Republicans sort of did it to themselves. Anyway, Kevin McCarthy looks like he is going to have a lot on his plate. And one person who's going to be right at the top of that menu of what could arrive on Kevin McCarthy's plate is George Santos, the New York Republican who is currently in a massive excrement storm of controversy. Reported by Patch on Tuesday, he is now under fire for potentially scamming a disabled military veteran who was raising money for his dog's cancer surgery. I mean, talk about a story that ticks just about any box. Disability, check. Military vet, check. Dog, check. Cancer, check. It's like the perfect story to paint someone as a big bad baddie in the political world. And he scammed them, allegedly. George Santos said in a response to the story, fake, no clue who this is. But Richard Ostoff is, you know, quite adamant that back in 2016, he sought Mr. Santos's help in raising $3,000 for the surgery. A veterinary technician had connected him with George Santos, who was using the name Anthony DeVolder at the time, saying he ran a charity named Friends of Pets United and can help. George Santos then ran a GoFundMe on Sapphire's behalf, allegedly, but then disappeared and stopped answering texts and calls. When confronted by a friend of Mr. Ostoff, George Santos allegedly says he planned to use the money to help other animals. Unfortunately, the story doesn't have a happy ending for Sapphire, the pit bull, who unfortunately, passed away in January 2017. Republican leaders in the House so far are protecting George Santos. They have protected him through a number of different scandals. This is just the tip of the iceberg. He is on so many ethics committee radars that, I mean, if you were the radar tech, you'd just be hearing a solid beep, 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 beep. You wouldn't be able to hear anything other than just a solid note. They wouldn't even identify as individual pings anymore. The Republican district attorney for Nassau County has said she's going to have to look into what's called numerous fabrications and inconsistencies on George Santos's CV, with alleged discrepancies in his backstory first made in a New York Times report in December. The newspaper published an investigation into Mr. Santos that said he made lies on his resume, including saying that he graduated from Barak College in New York and worked at high-profile Wall Street firms Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. George Santos admitted that he never worked for either of those firms and had lied about graduating from college, saying he's embarrassed that he had not. He was also accused of misrepresenting his Jewish ancestry. He told the New York Post in an interview back in December again that he was a Catholic and never claimed to be Jewish. But when, quote, I learned my maternal family had a Jewish background, I said I was Jew-ish. Not Jewish, Jew-ish. Sort of a bit Jewish. What a ridiculous story. He also says he's not a criminal and that the scandal would not prevent him from serving a 2-year term in the House of Representatives. He also has tweeted inconsistent stories about the death of his mother. Back in 2021, George Santos said 9/11 claimed my mother's life, which is quite it's quite a claim because she died in 2016. George Santos's campaign website now says that his mother was in her office in the South Tower on the original 2 World Trade Center on September the 11th, but survived and went on to die of cancer several years later. This district attorney says that residents of Mr. Santos's congressional district must have an honest and accountable representative in Congress. No one is above the law, and if a crime was committed in this county, we will prosecute it, says... what's the name of this district attorney? I can't see. I mean, it's really quite astonishing. George Santos has since admitted lying on his CV. He is under investigation from the House Ethics Committee, and he has inquiries on him from the US federal government and Brazilian fraud charges. Yeah. It's... Wow. He's allegedly lied about quite a lot of things. But the latest claims coming from Brazil. Brazil have confirmed they plan to revive fraud charges against Mr. Santos related to a 2008 stolen checkbook. According to court records, Mr. Santos spent about $700 using a false name and stolen checks near Rio de Janeiro in a city I'm not even going to try to pronounce. The case had to be suspended because Brazilian authorities were unable to locate him. But they found him now. He's in the US House of Representatives. In a statement to the BBC's US partner, CBS, the Brazilian prosecutor who was charged with the case has said that now George Santos is a congressman. That means he has a certain address where he can be summoned and the case can be continued. Oh, it really was just because he was sworn in as a congressman. They've now got an address they can find him at. Oh, that's hilarious. That's absolutely hilarious. On the 29th of December, though, the New York Times reported George Santos's campaign paid $11,000 to a cleaning company for apartment rental for staff, in addition to a slew of incomings and disbursements pegged at $199.99, exactly 1 cent below the threshold in which receipts are required by federal law. The campaign expenditures also include $40,000 for air travel. I mean, wow. The New York Times called this that it looks like the campaign filings of party leaders in Congress, as opposed to a newly elected freshman who's still introducing himself to local voters. We don't know whether the laws have been broken. Federal and local officials have vowed to look at his finances. And George Santos is taking office. And he's one of the crucial votes that was an ever-present for Kevin McCarthy. It's not what you know, is it? Now, something that's been that's broken in the last few minutes, sort of half an hour or so, retired Met police officers have now been charged with some more child sexual offences. Two more Metropolitan Police officers have been charged with child sex offences as part of an investigation into a serving Metropolitan Police Chief Inspector who was found dead. That investigation into Richard Watkinson. His death is being treated as unexplained but not suspicious, whereas Jack Addis and Jeremy Laxton are going to appear at Westminster Magistrates Court on the 9th of February. Chief Inspector Watkinson, deceased, was a serving chief inspector for neighbourhood policing in the West Area Command Unit of the Met and had been suspended from active duty following his arrest. He was then found dead in Buckinghamshire on the 12th of January. The same day, the Met says he was due to be charged with conspiracy to distribute or show indecent images of children, three counts of making indecent photos of a child, voyeurism, and two counts of misconduct in a public office. The inquest into Chief Inspector Watkinson's death has opened and adjourned. Commander John Saville from the Metropolitan Police's Professional Standards Team said Chief Inspector Watkinson was facing extremely serious and concerning charges as the result of a painstaking and thorough police investigation. Before this matter came to light, we had no previous information about these allegations or to indicate the officer posed any risk to the public. He had not faced any other criminal or conduct matters during his Met career. What's that delightful phrase about one bad apple? That's normally what gets said around the time of whenever one of these cases comes out. One bad apple. Well, do you know what the rest of that phrase is? Anyone? One bad apple spoils the bunch. Or spoils the barrel. And it does seem to. It certainly does in the Apple community, and it does appear to in the police as well. David Carrick is another name that won't exactly sort of imbue any trust in the police service. For almost two decades, Metropolitan Police Officer David Carrick, who was a serving armed Metropolitan Police Officer, falsely imprisoned, attacked and raped women. This in follow-up to the Wayne Cousins scandal. I mean, he was nicknamed the rapist. How do you let that sort of slip through? I mean, this is really not something that the Metropolitan Police need, but it's something that has to be stamped out. I don't know whether it will. Crack, I've just read that David Carrick pleaded guilty to 49 separate offences for 17 years. I mean, that's not so much one bad apple as a completely rotten tree. I don't know. Maybe it's not great to, I don't know, cut down on how stringent police training is. You never know. Maybe that the calls for 20,000 new police officers should be about 20,000 fully trained and brilliantly effective new police officers. Which I'm sure they are. I'm sure there are thousands and millions of them, and I'm sure that it is, to some degree, a case of one bad apple. But one bad apple really does spoil the barrel. Especially when it's about such a really important and vital public service. I mean, the police, crikey. If you can't trust them, who can you? I don't know, to be honest. But I do know it has to be dealt with. Let's go back to a story we started the show with as well. Let's go back to strikes, because the Rail Delivery Group has made a new offer to the RMT union following talks over the past week. This has been announced in the last half an hour. The deal includes a backdated pay rise of 5%, up from a previous offer of 4% and a 4% increase in 2023. The RDG received a mandate from the government, apparently, which ultimately holds the purse strings, but any agreement hinges on changes to working conditions. The National Executive Committee of the RMT will now consider the details of the offer. So there is a new pay offer on the table. There is some degree of negotiation, but still those critical concessions that the RMT look very unlikely to give, those red lines around working conditions, doesn't look like they're going to be removed. It's now a matter of weighing it up. Is it more important to stay out on strike in order for the unions to keep their red lines intact, or does it matter if you break one or two of them to get the best deal you can for your members? Who knows? Right. I think, crikey, we've got 10 minutes left of the show. That's unbelievable. I thought it was much longer than that left. Well, yeah, time flies when you're having fun, I guess. I hope you've been having fun listening in on Expression FM. If you've liked what you've heard, then do go check out the Politics Unboxed podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. You can go online to www.politicsunboxedpodcast.wordpress.com to find our online offerings. And, you know, get in touch. Email politics.unboxed@outlook.com or go to our social media at politics.unboxed on Instagram, at politicsu, that's the letter U, on Twitter, and Politics Unboxed on Facebook. Just, you know, search Politics Unboxed. It'll get you there. There isn't really too much time. I want to sort of dive into another story, but I kind of feel like there isn't too much time to really do that, which is obviously a shame. So I'm going to do some fun sports stories instead. Andy Murray is currently playing tennis in the Australian Open. Andy Murray has broken in the fourth set against, Thanasi Kokkinakis. This is the Australian Open second round. Murray lost the first two sets, 4-6, 6-7, but won the second set, 7-6 in a tiebreak, and is 5-2 up against Kokkinakis in the fourth. Is Murray going to wrap the set up early, wonders the BBC's live reporting. Who knows? Men's second seed Casper Ruud has been knocked out, though, and women's second seed Ons Jabeur with, well, it's quite a shock. Novak Djokovic was through, though, despite an injury worry. He went through 6-1, 6-7, 6-2, 6-love. Djokovic had to have a medical timeout with potential hamstring issues. Remember all that fuss about Novak Djokovic not being able to play in the Australian Open last year? Well, he's back now. Aston Villa are going to let go their forward Danny Ings. He's going to West Ham, to all accounts, and it could be a good move for him. West Ham need an out-and-out striker, and Danny Ings is a great goal scorer. Leicester are going to sign a new defender, Victor Christiansen, going to the club for £17 million. They've got a lot of defenders. He is a fullback, I believe. He made 15 appearances for Copenhagen before the World Cup break, and there have been quite a few long-term injuries for the Foxes, who currently sit 15th in the Premier League table, just 2 points above the relegation zone. So there's some good news for Brendan Rodgers. And for William Robinson, our old panellist and contributor, who's a Leicester City fan. You never know. Maybe he's listening in. Right. I really am rambling now, so I think it's time to bring this show to a close, really. We've talked at length about different political issues and stories. And we're going to bring this to a close with the BAFTA nominations, because I like film and TV. It's fun. Netflix's All Quiet on the Western Front leads the field. The new on-screen adaptation of Erich Maria Remarque's 1928 novel is the first film to secure 14 or more BAFTA nominations since The King's Speech in 2011. It got 14 on the nose. The Banshees of Inisherin and Everything Everywhere All at Once got 10 nominations. Elvis, the film starring Austin Butler, got 9. Tar got 5. And with 4 nominees each, After Sun, The Batman, Top Gun Maverick, The Whale, and Good Luck to You, Leo Grand. I mean, the 14 nominations for All Quiet on the Western Front means it ties with Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon from 2001, great year, as the first foreign language film with the most nominations in BAFTA history. Cate Blanchett, Emma Thompson, Colin Farrell, Michelle Yeoh, Eddie Redmayne and Viola Davis are all nominated in the acting category, along with Ke-Huy Quan from the Everything Everywhere All at Once film, and several massive box office smashes have been recognised. Top Gun Maverick and Avatar, The Way of Water. There are 45 films nominated across all categories. There are, however, some absences. Olivia Colman and Steven Spielberg. They aren't even on the long list, let alone the short list. But this year, the British Academy are using a new method to determine nominees. The BAFTA Film Festival will take place on the 19th of February, hosted by Richard E. Grant. Wowee. Big names. I remember when it used to be Stephen Fry. But it'll be at the Royal Festival Hall in London, and you'll be able to watch it on BBC One. Right then. I really do think this is time to end the show now. So thank you very much for listening. I always enjoy bringing these 2 hours worth of content to you, and I hope you enjoy listening to them. I'll be back next week with Politics Unboxed at 2 on a Thursday for 2 hours. And yeah, I know it's not quite the same time slot as it was last term, but it's only a 24-hour delay. Still once a week, every week for 2 hours, me talking about politics. Isn't that great? Anyway, I'm rambling because I'm trying to find a good song to play out. And I don't know. That's a good song. There's a couple of Bond themes around here, which is brilliant. I love a good Bond theme, but I don't think I'm going to play a Bond theme. It needs to be a lovely song. It needs to be nice and fun. It needs to be poppy and peppy. Ooh, that's a great song. Yeah. Gonna leave you with an icon. Absolute icon of rock and roll. Tina Turner. So, whilst you listen to a song all about a proud Mary, I will say thank you very much for listening. I hope to see you next week. Every now and then. I want you all dancing around your kitchens listening to this, because it's a great song. And then, yeah, I'll be back, same time, same place, next week. Enjoy, and I'll see you then. I'll let you just sort of ooze into this song. Which bit do you like most? The intro, or when it all steps up a gear? I quite like this bit, actually. Oh, yeah. Very nice. Let's get all gospel, have some fun. I'll see you next week. Thanks very much. Left a good